Topic of tonight's Dhamma talk is, as certainly you can imagine, Vipassana Upakilesa Part 2, namely the 10 Imperfections Part 2. And the 10 imperfections of insight are the following, as we've outlined already last night. The first one is illumination. And then the second one is knowledge, jnana, and the third one is joy and rapture, piti. And then as number four we have which one? Tranquility, yes, correct, pasadi. And then the next one is happiness, sukha, followed by determined faith, and then comes strong effort, pagaha in Pali. The next one is strong mindfulness, upatana in Pali. And the very last one is attachment, nikanti. Now out of those 10, we've dealt with already 5, including happiness. However, I did mention though that under tranquility there are a number of other states that tend to arise together with it. And so when tranquility arises in our meditation practice as an imperfection of insight, then there's a good likelihood that which other mental state will also arise?
Joy.
That arises before the tranquility. Serenity, that's same thing as there we go, lightness, yes indeed. So the mental factor of lightness, lahuta in the Pali scriptural language. And this then has the result, or will be experienced by a meditator as sometimes a tremendous amount of lightness during the sitting meditation, but this may also occur during the walking meditation. So meditators seem to be floating around, and as if their steps are cushioned, air cushioned. Now, the next, apart from lahuta, another mental state that tends to arise is known as malleability. And the Pali term for this is mudita. And the malleability refers actually to two things, namely of consciousness, and then there's also malleability of the mind body. And by mind body, this is a term, a technical term, that simply refers to the body of mental states, so the entirety of the mental states or mental factors. Now the interesting thing about malleability is that its character is the subsiding of rigidity. And rigidity in Pali is given as tamba. And so in a moment or two, I'll mention mental states that lead or that cause rigidity of mind. Now, the function of this malleability is given as crushing rigidity of mind, and then it is manifested as non-resistance. So that's the way a meditator experiences it in his or her practice. So non-resistance to what is happening in the meditation practice. And this malleability is said to be opposed to mental states such as wrong view, mecha deity, and pride and conceit. And both of them are said to create rigidity of the mind. Now, with pride and conceit, you know, this is certainly somewhat obvious. When looking at a person who's terribly conceited, let's say sometimes, not during this retreat, but other times, sometimes there is a meditator who is maybe new to the practice and still full of haughtiness, and then when it comes to bowing down, the person experiences certainly some difficulty there, and the head simply just doesn't want to go down, and the text says there's oftentimes a rigidity of the neck, and there is indeed, and so these kind of people not just display an external form of rigidity, but also an internal mental type of rigidity. And so then view, and in particular wrong view, may very much contribute to the same phenomenon. Now, just for the sake of general knowledge, let me add or let me say a few things about view or wrong view. First of all, Buddhism distinguishes two kinds of view, namely right view and wrong view. The first one is given as Samma Deity, and the second one is given as wrong view is given as Maccha Deity in the Pali scriptural language. And oftentimes, when simply the term deity is mentioned, then one should understand by it Maccha Deity, namely wrong view. Now, this wrong view can be defined as seeing things wrongly. And its characteristic, according to the Visuddhimagga, is unwise or unjustified interpretation of things. So things of the world. And its function is to pre-assume, and it is manifested as a wrong interpretation or belief. And its proximate cause is certainly the unwillingness to see the noble ones. And so unwillingness to see the noble ones here means when one doesn't go and seek out their teachings, then one will miss an opportunity to see to gain a new perspective on life. And so this view or wrong view, then in the Dhamma Sangani, the first Abhidhamma work, gets explained by way of synonyms in the following ways. And this then will help us already to gain a better understanding of what is meant by views. And so there, it is referred to as the thicket of wrong view, Deity Gahana in the Pali scriptural language. And then there's also mention of wilderness of wrong view, Deity Kantara, and then the thorny spike of wrong view, and then the inconsistency of wrong view, and then the fetter of wrong view, Deity Samyojana, and then it's also given as an obsession and establishment in wrong view, and furthermore inclination towards wrong view or misconception. Now, views, and so when we speak of views, then under the term right view or correct view comes what? There are two forms of right view, namely mundane, on a mundane level, and then more or less on a super mundane level. Who knows? Well, on a mundane level, right or correct view consists of the right view on karma, the law on karma, the law of action and result. And this law simply says that wholesome deeds will lead to wholesome results, and unwholesome deeds will lead to unwholesome results. And so, in terms of supramundane right view, or higher, or let's put it better, superior high view, right view, are mentioned the Four Noble Truths, namely the noble truth of the existence of suffering, and then the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Now, when it comes to right view or correct view, samadhi deity, it's the first of the eight path factors of the Eightfold Noble Path, and in a sense, it all starts with this, namely that one has some some understanding of right view. One first hears it, one studies it, one reflects on it, and but this is not enough, and then later on one does like we all do here, one actually meditates, and then in the course of the meditation practice an intuitive and very direct understanding of the Four Noble Truths does arise, and in particular upon the realization of path and fruition knowledge. Now, views are very subtle things. They're very subtle, phenomena or events in the mind. However, views can have a tremendous effects in life. Now, let's start from obvious. In the context of our imperfections of insight, it was mentioned yesterday that a wrong view, such as mistaking any of those imperfections to be a nibbanic experience, if this view is held onto and believed in, may lead to an ending of one's practice, stopping of one's practice. So one has all these wonderful experiences, like joy is there, and tranquility is there, and happiness is there, and knows, okay, this is Dhamma delight, and enjoys this and misinterprets this to be Nibbana, when of course it is not Nibbana yet. And thus, a meditator then may be misled to think, okay, the Dhamma has been attained, now I can go home. And so that would be a huge mistake, because the practice is just in the process of developing and has not yet reached any supramundane level. Now, views govern, even though they're extremely subtle, but they govern what we eat. So in which sense? Well, whether we're a meat eater or a vegetarian, you know, will depend on certain views, or on views that we're holding. So if we've come to believe that eating meats products is contributes to a lot of violence towards animals, then we may decide, okay, from now onwards I'm not going to eat any meat anymore. And so, and then views may also very much govern the clothes that we're wearing, and they may also very much, and this is obvious, govern our understanding or our thinking on the political system. So how a country, how government should be running a country, and may lead to tremendous clashes. If I just think of Nepal and Lumbini, the birthplace of the Buddha, lies in Nepal until not too long ago, last year, we've had an 11-year-old insurgency, and the Maoists of Nepal having or holding on to some very certain set of views about how society should be structured, and who should govern the country, and how to achieve their goals, their political goals, and this even includes embracing violence, so killing people and whatnot. And so the views that the Maoists are holding, and likewise we can say the views that the government is representing, then determine how these two groups, government and Maoist, or now in between we have even more liberation groups and armies. So there's a whole variety there. And this then determines their actions. And at times this can be rather causing a lot of bloodshed. Now views also occur in a religious context, and such as views about what to offer or what to sacrifice. And just to give you maybe one or two things along a spectrum. Well, in Buddhism there is, no, in Christianity, let's start with that, in Christianity there is this notion of offering, offering, eating bread and taking wine, and takes on a particular significance. And then in Buddhism one would typically offer maybe a candle or some flowers or some fruits and the like. Now, in a particular religion, there is, and this can be, recently we did witness this in Nepal, there is a belief or a view that by slaughtering 111 buffaloes, well, the destiny of the ruler of the country can be changed. Now, just imagine the poor buffaloes that get killed for this particular view. And it actually happened. And so every year, and it's sort of really hard, wrenching to see and to hear, at a particular, during a particular festival, people go and do animal sacrifices, ranging all the way from sacrificing maybe a cock or a hen to a goat, up to a buffalo, and then the blood of the animals slaughtered and sacrificed is even being poured about the over the wheels of the cars that people are using, and so this then is supposed to be a good omen or whatnot, and so, and then. Well, there are also views about numerology, so certain numbers are supposed to bring in luck and others not, or like driving in a car and having a snake crawl across the road. This is supposed to bring to be a sign of good luck, and then seeing certain birds flying across the sky, these two, and then is being interpreted in various ways. Now, and then on top of this, we have views regarding religious content. And so these certain views naturally then will differ from one denomination to the next. Now, in the course of the meditation practice, well, the various kinds of views that we as ordinary human beings tend to hold gets gradually weakened and, if not, uprooted. And can you think of one such view that we've discussed already at great length?
No.
Pardon me?
Self.
Yes, it's correct. The view of self and the wrongful belief in the existence of a self in the Pali scriptural language known as Sakaya Deity. And so as a meditator is going through the different insight knowledges, then starting from the very first one, one gains a first understanding of non-identification of the mind with objects. So objects are no longer seen as my rising, falling, my pain or my ache, my anger, and so on, but rather as just anger, pain, and rising and falling. And so then in the third insight knowledge, as we've discussed, when we experience anatta, then the belief in the existence of a, the notion of atta, of a self, gets at least temporarily replaced. And it is with the attainment of the first path, namely the path of stream entry, that this belief, wrongful belief in the existence of a self, then gets uprooted. Now, other beliefs that also get uprooted in the course of the practice are beliefs or views such as the eternity view, that even after death life goes on, the self or the soul goes on to exist, and this happens with the fourth insight knowledge, in particular fourth and fifth insight knowledge, especially when one sees the dissolution of formations. And then, furthermore, one also with the fourth insight knowledge, and this time with seeing the arising or the origination of formations, one understands that the annihilationist view lacks substance. And then there is another view that gets uprooted or weakened and uprooted through the practice, and this is the so-called ahetuka deity or ahetu pachaya deity, which is in brief translated in English as the no cause view. So believing that there is no particular cause to the phenomenon that we experience, and that things are happening, everything is predestined by faith, by fate, sorry, not faith. And so it is when a meditator experiences the second insight knowledge, which is the knowledge of discerning cause and effect, then this view starts shaking somewhat, because one realizes for oneself over and over again that certain formations are not happening without a cause, but that there is a cause. And another view that also gets uprooted in the course of the meditation practice is that of akiriya vada, namely the belief that there is no effect of one's or to one's actions. So one can do what everyone likes, and whether wholesome or unwholesome, there will not be any results. And so this then, and again in our meditation, as we develop wholesome mental states, we gain wholesome results, and we progress in our meditation practice. And in a very direct manner, we can see how when we leave the mind unguarded, that unwholesome mental states will arise, and these in turn will cause much suffering. Now, so when it comes to these certain views, then it's certainly good to keep an open mind and certainly simply following the Buddha's advice, simply just to observe whatever is actually happening in the body and in the mind. And the Buddha has described the Dhamma as possessing a particular quality, namely given in Pali as ehipasiko, come and see for yourself. So the invitation to come and see. And so not to take this Dhamma, not to buy into it, into the whole package, without testing it in any way. And as is certainly well known, the Buddha has certainly made it very clear in the in his discourse to the Kalamas that one should not certainly believe things simply because they've been handed down from one generation to another, or because certainly some famous person is certainly teaching these things, but rather one should subject every aspect of the teaching to a test and see whether it's certainly really true or not. And one should then accept only that what certainly one has found for oneself to be true. And so aspects of the Dhamma, of the Buddha's Dhamma, that still remain untested, not certainly that certainly clear. Well, no one is well advised to simply put them into the pending file and certainly then wait until one's practice develops certainly further. And oftentimes, and that's the amazing thing, oftentimes certain questions that one unresolved questions that have arisen over time, with the deepening of one's meditation, then an answer comes up, or they find their answer. So maybe this much regarding views. So in our meditation practice, it's important to see that these views can influence certain our meditation much, and so to keep the mind quite free from them as much as certain possible. Maybe to give you one more example, practical example, what a view can do. Maybe 20, 30 years ago, meditation practice in the West was kind of socially something that only people at the edges of society would, or at the periphery of society, would indulge in or engage in. But now, fortunately, things have changed, and so now meditation in this country has become even a mainstream activity. Nothing unusual, and certain people are even supportive of it. So maybe 20, 30 years ago, even if a person would have had inclination and all the qualities to do the practice successfully, simply just because the social view or the general the view of the general public was against meditation, well, this then prevented many people from actually doing the practice. Now, other mental states that might arise together with tranquility are given as kamanyata in the Pali language, which is wieldiness of the mind, and its characteristic is the subsiding of unwieldiness, and its function is to crush that unwieldiness, and it is manifested as success of the mind in making something an object of observation. And then the next one is that of proficiency, and it's certain pagunyata in the Pali scripture language, and its characteristic is that of healthiness of the mind, and its function is to crush the unhealthiness of the mind, and it manifests as an absence of disability. And this proficiency, pagunyata, is opposed to things that create a certain unhealthiness of mind, such as a lack of faith and so on. And the rectitude or straightforwardness as a mental factor we've discussed already yesterday. Now, the next, the imperfection of the insight to look at is that of determined faith, and this in the Pali language is given as adimokkha. Now, This term can assume different meanings, and certainly sometimes it's being translated as firm resolve, as determination, as determined faith, or decision, or resolution. And the Visuddhimagga says that certainly this Adimokkha is resolution, and certainly resolution stands certain is the same thing as certain faith. So Adimokkha is equal to faith. And so this certain faith is said certain to, or strong faith is certain said to arise in the context of insight meditation. Now, from Adimokkha itself is a mental state that is one of the mental states, actually different from from faith, somewhat certainly different. And literally it means the releasing of the mind onto an object of observation. And it has been translated as decision or resolution. And its characteristic is that of conviction, and the function is of not groping. Now, this means, let's say, you've been all your life, you've known that there is more to human existence than just indulgence in the sense pleasures. However, you couldn't quite figure out how to get to this deeper level deeper meaning of life. So you go around, you check out this practice, that practice, and so on. So you're groping in the dark. But then finally you come upon a practice that really suits you, and that you feel is really leading you further, and is carrying this deeper meaning. And with this, there's no more groping, and with this, then there is certain a decision, yes, this is it, and I'll stick to this for the rest of my life. Hence, the manifestation of this Adimokkha is certainly given, decision is given as decisiveness, namely being unclear, and certainly playing with different options, but coming to a decision. And the proximate cause for the arising of this Adimokkha decision is to have a thing that one is convinced about. Now, the Venerable Mahasiddhanta of Burma explains it as certain follows. He says it is a very clear faith and confidence that arises together with a noting and certain observing mind. And so he says that because of the presence of this certain strong faith and certain confidence, the mind is free from impurities. And thus the mind is certainly very clear. Now, there is a logical explanation for the arising of this determined faith in our meditation practice. And so what do you think leads to Adimokkha? What kind of experiences?
Insight knowledge.
The insight knowledge is
the direct experience, your own direct experience.
Yes, yes, in a general sense, yes. And if you think in terms of the imperfections,
concentration, mindfulness.
Well, they all contribute. Very simple. Experiences like joy and then tranquility and happiness, especially those three, in plus for some the illumination and also the strong or unerring, keen, incisive, sharp knowledge. So when a meditator has all these wonderful experiences, naturally one develops lots of faith in this practice. Like previously, I've never had these kind of experiences, at least not to this extent, and now all of this is happening, this is just fabulous. And so then one realizes with this, one realizes the potential of of the mind, but also the potential of the practice. So the meditation leads you to experiences that under normal circumstances are not easily available. And so what arises out of this is much determined faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and in particular in the practice. And even if the faith in the Buddha and Dhamma is Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha isn't all that strong, but at least there'll be strong faith in the meditation practice itself. And so, so a meditator comes to the conclusion, yes, this is it, and this is what I'm going to continue to do, some say even until the end of my life, or my the end of my days. And so, and when this adimokkha arises in our meditation practice, and then it manifests in very peculiar ways. Now, most of you have experienced already some determined faith, and so what can you think of? Oh, it takes me on a retreat. Yes. Go on. And what next? There's many manifestations here. Yes, Jeff.
It keeps you on a difficult object when you're observing.
It keeps you on a difficult object. Yes, this might... could well be. Well, more direct things. So you have all these wonderful experiences, and then you think of your loved ones, loved ones at home, your friends, your relatives, and so on, near and dear ones, and then you want them to experience what you've just experienced. No? So you have all these wonderful experiences, and you want to share them with others. You want others to gain the same thing. And so, then well, the intention arises, okay, let me call my dear person so and so right away. And so then you're heading for the next telephone. However, there are no telephones around here. So this thing, at least around here, will not work. But in Burma, and other places, it does indeed happen just like this. Or if as a meditator you go to some Asian country like Burma, Thailand or so, and you practice there intensively, and then you have all these wonderful experiences, and you feel really, like I said the other day, like being on the top of the world, then the telephone is out of question, and then you might find yourself writing long letters and describing all the experiences that you've had, and then asking the other person, please go and book a ticket or get the next flight to one of these Asian countries and come and join me in the retreat or for the retreat. And so, Well, for some, it doesn't take these forms, but it's more limited to the near, the people around. And so if a meditator has had some outstanding experiences, then he or she may take a look at the other meditators in the group and find, oh, that meditator over there is not practicing all that well and seems to be a little bit sluggish. Maybe I should talk to this person and encourage this person. And then one gets off on a missionary run. Then another manifestation that's not too unusual either of this determined faith is that the meditator has all these wonderful experiences and then sees the Buddha statue up there and reflects on the serenity of it and the outstanding nature of the Buddha himself as a person, as a teacher, and one thinks of the Dhamma, of the Sangha, and one starts bowing, slowly, mindfully, the first time, the second time, the third time, the fourth time, the fifth time, and it goes on like this many times. And one might even be shedding some tears because one is emotionally somewhat agitated. And there are some meditators, and these are usually the somewhat more confident meditators who, while on retreat, while they're having all these wonderful experiences, already in the mind write their first Dhamma talks. Namely, the Dhamma talks that they're going to give once they get back home. And some take it even a step further. They write, they arrange not just the first few Dhamma talks, but they already plan their career, their future career as a Dhamma teacher. And so whether this is useful or not, I don't know. At least at this point, one thing is for sure, and at this point one is well advised to simply just label all of this, to recognize this as determined faith, and then not to get carried away, and then to go back to our ordinary labeling and ordinary non-reactive observation and knowing the nature of what is going on. And if one does so, then all of this will gradually subside and one will be quite okay again. Now, so with regard to this imperfection of insight as or determined faith, the same thing holds true as with the others. Namely, there are three potential dangers, and those dangers lie in a craving the mental state of determined faith, and then furthermore the arising of pride and conceit, and wrong view. And here, wrong view might come in the form of the idea, oh, well, maybe this is it, and I'm having all the necessary experiences that qualify me as a teacher, then after this retreat I can start teaching. And that would be a little bit premature. And so the next imperfection of insight is that of bagaha or energy. And the way this manifests is that a meditator simply all of a sudden has lots of energy at his or her disposal. And early on, one was suffering from a lack of energy and much sluggishness, dullness of the mind, and so one could barely get oneself or pull oneself through a sitting and barely do the walking meditation. Now, once the pagaha is there, the meditation is a piece of cake. And so, it doesn't require any major effort. So what happens is that because the controlling faculties, namely the two pairs of effort and concentration, and the pair of faith and wisdom, are well balanced, and the mind as a whole becomes more balanced, because of this one has more energy available. And now this increase of the energy at this point actually does not represent excessive energy, and it does not necessarily lead to restlessness, as would be the case if one were to exert too hard. So well-known case or extreme is too much effort leads to restlessness, but here it's not happening like this. And so the effort that is present here, the energy that is present at this point, is an energy that is neither, or an effort that is neither too lax nor too strained. So just right. Now, the way this certain energy then manifests in one's certain meditation practice is quite obvious. A meditator finds that all of that sluggishness, sloth and torpor and so on is gone, and the mind is alert, awake and energetic. And then one also finds that one can easily sit for longer stretches. So if previously one barely managed to do 1 hour, now one can do a sitting of 1.5 hours, 2 hours, some meditators even up to 3 hours. And so it doesn't it's not really all that difficult to do. And some same thing in the walking meditation. The walking meditation unfolds quite easily. And then let me see. At this point in the practice, meditators find, or may find, that previously, towards the last sitting or during the last sitting of the day, they would frequently get really drowsy and have a really hard time to get through that last sitting. But now, the situation changes, and despite of the fact that it's the last sitting of the day and it's been a long day, yet the mind is still filled with energy. And some meditators furthermore experience that that they wake up earlier in the morning, the mind is all refreshed, and the body is also well rested, even though one has slept less than one would ordinarily do. Now, another manifestation of this pagaha at this point in the practice is that some meditators go on practicing sitting, walking, not sitting, walking without lying down, not only during the daytime but also during the night. And so one finds oneself to be the last person in the hall at night, and then there's still a lot of energy left. One really doesn't feel tired, one doesn't feel like going to bed, and one then decides to push it a little bit. And then one does some walking meditation, that goes well. One sits for another stretch, that also goes well. And then after that, one feels one still has some energy left. There's no other meditator around, and one does walking meditation, sitting meditation throughout the whole night. And then and one is the first person in the hall one is the only person in the hall throughout the night, and then to greet those who come in after having slept several hours. And so this kind of an energetic practice is possible sometimes for a 24-hour period, for some even for a 48-hour period, and for in rare cases, even more than this. Now, when it happens like this, when one has much energy available or at one's disposal, then one should not waste the opportunity by going to bed at 7 p.m. but or let's say by 8 o'clock, but rather put it to good use. And this then will further deepen one's practice. Now, the dangers are the same, namely, they occur in the form of craving, of pride and conceit, and wrong view. So one is well advised not to buy into these. And simply, when there is one finds there is a strong effort, and the energy is coming naturally, then to be mindful of this, and to label it, to observe it, and to know it, and simply go on practicing. Now, the eighth imperfection of insight is that of strong mindfulness, upatthana, and this upatthana actually means establishment, and this term is used in the connection of satipatthana, so establishment of mindfulness. Now, the mindfulness that is referred to here is again a mindfulness naturally that arises in the context of insight meditation, and it is a mindfulness that comes naturally, that comes effortlessly. And on top of this, that comes easy, that is continuous, and that is not missing any major object. So an object, even if objects arise in a quick succession, the mindfulness is quick enough and sharp enough to go with the flow, to go with what is happening. So it's swift and also very sharp and light, and we can say at this point the mindfulness is dynamic in nature. Now, this contrasts greatly from the mindfulness that we experienced before, which tended to be much slower, and oftentimes still missing the predominant object of observation. Now, the Venerable Mahasisayadaw points out that in the context of this strong mindfulness, it may seem to a meditator at times as if the objects were coming towards the mind, and at other times it may be it certainly may appear as if the mind is quite naturally going towards the predominant object of observation. And so again, because one's mindfulness is so so sharp and outstanding and has these wonderful qualities, a meditator may be misled to think that he or she has gained the supermundane path knowledge, and with this then one's practice will stagnate. So thinking like this leads tantamount to the arising of a wrong view, and this then leads to stagnation or even a drop in one's practice. So one has to be careful when one's mindfulness is as good as described here, to be mindful of it, and not to let any craving, any pride and conceit and wrong view come in. Now, the ninth imperfection, the second last one, is that of equanimity, and this is an interesting point, or an interesting mental state. And the texts point out, the Visuddhimagga points out, that actually it refers, equanimity refers to two kinds of equanimity. And so one is equanimity in insight, and the other one is known as equanimity in adverting. Now, equanimity and insight, dattara majjatatta upeka in Pali, is referred to, or it is given as neutrality in the investigation of formations or objects as they are occurring. And so, that neutrality in one's investigation is present because one has observed those same objects already many hundreds, if not a thousand times. So, to bring or make this point even clearer, previously, especially at the outset of one's practice, the mind was still very much, or the mind is very much swayed by desirable objects and undesirable objects. And so developing a liking towards the desirable objects and developing a disliking towards the undesirable objects. And so there's much reactivity there, which means there's no equanimity present. However, having observed objects like a wandering mind already many times, and many other objects, and one knows it's just another mental object, so what isn't really, it isn't really all that special or special thought, and brings the mindset is neutral about the object occurring. And so this is one aspect here under equanimity. The other one is given in Pali as avajjana upekkha. Upekkha is equanimity, and avajjana means adverting. Now, adverting or advertence refers to that particular function of consciousness that adverts to the next object. So let's say we're sitting in meditation, and then we hear some thunder. And so then naturally the mind will advert towards the ear door, and so then the mind will go through the so-called cognitive process and then process this audible datum. And So here, this avajana upeka is to be understood as equanimity in adverting in the mind door. See, there are six sense doors. There's the eye door, the ear door, the nose door, the tongue door, the body door, and as the last one, the mind door. So mind door stands for objects that enter, so to speak, the mind. And so this covers objects that may arise in the mind door are your memories, are your mental states, and then also your feelings, and then the awareness of awareness, the knowledge of some bodily sensation, and so on and so forth. And so there is equanimity in the advertence towards in the mind door. And this advertence, it is said, is working very incisively and in a very sharp manner, and as sharp as a sharp and as quick as a flash of lightning. See, to explain this point a little bit further, it may not be all that obvious to you. When you contemplate mental objects, and then you may have come across an experience where the mind is kind of going back and forth between, or where the mind is wavering, and it doesn't quite know which object to turn to next. And so maybe there's some undesirable object, and even though it's quite predominant, the mind that doesn't want to go there. So that would then mean that there is no equanimity in advertence. Or in another case, there may be a desirable object, and easily the mind goes there with much interest. And so when it comes to this equanimity in advertence, the mind has no preference, and so in an incisive and a sharp manner and quick manner does it go does it advert towards the predominant object. Now, the last imperfection of insight is that of attachment, nikanti, and this imperfection is said to underlie all of the others in a subtle way, and when it arises, then we should be mindful of it. So when we notice that there is attachment to a certain experience, the present experience, then we simply just label it and observe it, know its nature, and let go of it. And so this then covers the 10 imperfections. Skilled and professional meditator will go through this phase governed by the 10 imperfections, and will not be influenced by the imperfections, and just will remember to be mindful of whatever object arises, and without developing any craving, pride and conceit, and wrong view, nor getting attached to the respective experience. And as a result of this, the person will quickly cross these 10 imperfections, and with this then the practice will move on. Now, this particular phase where the imperfections arise represents a rather distinct point in one's meditation practice. And when we and in terms of the, you know, seven purifications, it is known as purification by knowledge and vision of what is the path and the not path. So there's mention here of the correct path and the not path. And the not path lies in getting attached to all these experiences, indulging in them, celebrating them, wanting more and more of them. And the correct path simply lies in remembering to be mindful and just to label and observe and to know whatever comes along. So this then represents a major crossroads junction in our meditation practice. Now, from a practical point of view, even though a meditation teacher may remind meditators over and over again, don't get attached to these experiences, they will frequently not hear it, and or will say yes, and then in the actual the meditation will forget about the advice, and they will just get totally attached to the experience. And however, and getting attached to the experience and then experiencing Dhamma delight over and over and over again, but there is an inbuilt mechanism. Sooner or later, one gets tired of joy and rapture, one gets tired of tranquility. If one has already experienced it for 5 days non-stop, and one also gets tired of happiness and the other imperfections of insight. And then one will realize that indulging in these experiences is a real dead-end road. And so it just doesn't lead anywhere. And whereas, and then the meditator gets the point, and so then they will remember to be mindful. And once this shift in understanding takes place, then quite naturally will the meditator move ahead again. So that's the major point here. And so, then it is important for a meditator to gain these 10 imperfections of insight during a retreat. And for a very simple reason. Imagine you were on a 10-day retreat instead of a 20-day retreat. And your practice is in the midst of dukkha. So dukkha and jnana as part of the third insight knowledge, and so you're experiencing lots of pains and aches and lots of unwholesome and destructive mental states. Well, and certainly with this you end the retreat and you go back home. And so, with this, once you're back home, will you have wonderful memories of the retreat? Not really. And however, if one does a somewhat longer retreat and then has time to go beyond the third insight knowledge, and then the imperfections come or arise in one's practice, and then one has all these wonderful experiences, and naturally faith will be there, and naturally one will be highly motivated to go on in one's meditation, thinking if this much is possible during a retreat, then if I were to practice even longer, there'll be even better results to come or to be expected. And so based on good experiences, a meditator feels inspired to continue with insight meditation and will eventually reach the goal. And so when we look at the way path of insight meditation is unfolding, then we find there are vipassana goodies all along. So once in a while we have to go through a so-called down or a trough, and then comes fortunately comes some rather inspiring experience, and so with this we feel motivated again to continue, and then after that we might hit again some difficult spot, and shortly after that again some inspiring experience comes. And so also what one experiences during the 10 imperfections of insight may be extremely useful for one's daily life. So just think of mental qualities such as tranquility, or think of the energy, strong energy, strong mindfulness, and in particular equanimity. Now, equanimity is a mental factor which at the beginning of one's retreat is not obvious at all. It's present in a dormant state in the mind, but it's not showing. And many people really don't quite know what is meant by equanimity. But at this point here, where one experiences the imperfections, one gains a first and direct understanding of what equanimity is all about. One learns to appreciate it, and then will serve as a reference point for one's daily life. And the next time one is exposed to some difficult situation, one and the mind is somewhat agitated, one might remember this quality of equanimity and remain more balanced in the face of those certain difficulties. And then, just as an anecdote to share with you, once there was a foreign meditator. He was from a European country, and then later on he moved to New York, if I remember well. And he came he had a habit of maybe once a year or so doing a retreat in Burma, and he would practice. He would practice until he would get to these imperfections of insight. And then he would say, okay, this much is enough. I don't want to go any further in my practice. I'm delighted with these wonderful mental states. Nibbana is not interesting for me. And and there was no, this meditator once practiced at the Panditarama meditation center in Yangon, and there was no way talking him into going beyond these imperfections. He would simply not give them up, and so he would experience them and hold on to them until the end of his retreat, and then leave the retreat, leave the country. So kindly, please don't do like this. And so the imperfections are just like an appetizer, but the main dish, the main benefits or the fruits of the practice are to come later on. Now, this then brings brings us to the end of our talk tonight. Let me conclude by wishing may all of you experience these imperfections fully, comprehensively, and may you well be skillful, may you be the skillful and professional meditator who can see through those imperfections and not get caught up in them in any way, and thus strongly inspired may you go on in your meditation practice and eventually reach the peace of Nibbana. And this is it for tonight. Do you have any questions, shorter or longer? Yes, Jackie.
I just have one to have clarity on averting equanimity.
Yes.
You used lightning as an example. You're saying then with averting equanimity, the meditator may be observing a particular object. Then the hearing door opens because they hear the lightning. But with averting equanimity, they have the skill to hear it, close it, and return back to the predominant object.
Yeah, the mind immediately goes there.
Okay.
And, immediately, without wavering or so. Without wavering and without reacting, mm-hmm. I suppose. Okay, and then? Any other comments, questions? Well, if not, then that's it for tonight.